Blog Talk Radio.
Anybody know who Willie Lynch was? Anybody? Raise your hand. No one? He was a vicious slave owner in the West Indies. The slave masters in the colony of Virginia were having trouble controlling their slaves, so they sent for Mr. Lynch to teach them his methods. The word lynching came from his last name. His methods were very simple, but they were diabolical. Keep the slave physically strong, but psychologically weak and dependent on the slave master. Keep the body, take the mind. I and every other professor on this campus are here to help you to find, take back, and keep your righteous mind. Because obviously, you have lost it.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else.
Hawk, who goes yonder?
It is I, sire, Richard of Nottingham.
Well, speak up, man, what is it?
News from the east, sire. Rick the Ruler has returned.
It's abracadabra, a la baby professor. All hail funk and lesson. Sweet tongue, grand writer of scrolls. Now behold, let the legend unfold. Born in a cosmos where no time and space do exist. Vibe in the midst of the chaos. Mortals label me as a logic.
You're traveling to another radio show. A broadcast not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of the imagination. That's the on-air sign up ahead. Your next stop, Afro Nerd Radio, with your guide, Diva, a.k.a. Afro Nerd.
Good evening, folks. Your heroes have arrived. Folks, listen, we have a stellar show today, a stellar show. We have iconic saxophonist Maceo Parker in the house. And of course, folks, listen, we do a certain type of show. You know what we do. We have serious guests, serious music. We do what we do. Before we speak to Mr. Parker, let me give out the call-in number. The call-in number is 646-915-9620. Again, 646-915-9620. Before we speak to Mr. Parker, we're going to have to get to a quick groove, about a minute of a groove that I'm sure he's familiar with. This is one of his tunes, Chicken, the great Maceo Parker. We'll get back. Bear with us, folks. We have royalty in the house. One moment. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, giving you a skosh, giving you a taste of funk. I don't think you can quite handle it. Giving you a skosh of funk. Again, folks, welcome to Afner featuring Captain Kirk, a.k.a. Afner Radio. Of course, I could not do the show without my partner in White Collar Crime. Speaking of the Captain, it's time to beam up for the funk. Come on, Cap, let's get to it.
I just had to cut the intro short. Let's just get right into it. Hey, Maceo! I just wanted to
okay.
say.
Oh, he was. Okay, hold on 1 second. Let me just cue him in, the gentleman in. One moment. Yeah, I like to have a lot of fanfare, Captain. Now all of a sudden my cue is not working properly. Let's see. Where are we here? Well, you know what? Let me just bring the gentleman in without the fanfare, unfortunately. Okay. Mr. Parker.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to Afternet Radio, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Listen, I can say unabashedly you're definitely one of my idols. We grew up listening to your music, and I was very excited when I saw your book. I read the entire book. It was definitely an enjoyable read. Very visual. Very visual. When you're reading it, you can actually see it. One question I have to ask you that's been really in the back of my mind, who was the culprit that actually did the peeing in the bed? Who was the actual culprit?
Me and my brothers.
Yeah. I thought that was a cute story. Very cute. What led you to write your memoir? What was the actual impetus behind you writing it?
Well, actually, you know, getting on in life, getting on in the career, urging on from my, you know, my managers, my producers, you know, people in the family. Just, you know, say, hey, man, why don't you write, you know, put something together, you know, this kind of thing. So that's really what was the basis of the whole thing.
So
and while my mind is still clear, you know, of events.
So you basically felt it was just time. Your family said it's just time for you to really start to put this stuff down.
Right, exactly. But not only family, you know, the whole list of people that I just named, managers, producers, you know, family friends. I think Fred Wesley has a book. You know, he said, you know, man, you gotta come out with a book. You know, Fred, another one of my friends from James Brown. Incidentally, that chicken was actually written by another one of my partners from James Brown, Pee Wee Ellis. That's his tune. That's my group playing the song, that chicken. But it's actually his tune. But you know, my career has expanded a lot of years, and you know, since day one or from day one right up to now, there's a lot of happening and has happened, and it was a lot of encouragement of, man, you got to jot some of this stuff down and put it down in a book form, and that's what we did.
I tell you something, in reading the book, because it was so visual, I was sad because I could see how you and your brothers became successful. I could actually see how it happened and how black life was in North Carolina, how it was during that time period. Well, you had a lot of mentorship, a lot of musicality around you, and today I don't see that today. Walk us through a little bit about your mentorship with your parents singing Louis Jordan in the house. What was that like?
Well, you have to use what's available, and you know all these things just happen to be available to us. You know, first of all, there was a whole lot of love. You know, we were poor, but they had ways of camouflaging the fact that we were poor. And I think one of the ways that they did it was through singing. Yeah, we sang all the time, and which made me sort of, you know, be in love with singing. So I'm going to school. You know, I love going to school because I know we're going to be singing sometimes. You know, and I mean school songs, church songs, Sunday school songs. You know, it just was a happy kind of upbringing, and you know, especially with my brothers, And once we got to the point where I got a trombone playing brother that was 1 year older than me and a drummer playing brother that was 1 year younger than me. And ever since we were like 9, 10, 11, 10, 11, 12, da, 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 up, you know, we started. And, you know, when we looked and noticed we had three, it's kind of like, okay, we got a group. So we just played all the time, dot, 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 all the time, all the time, all the time. And, you know, developing concepts and, you know, listening to everything we could possibly listen to. I was fortunate enough to have a saxophone player to come in as a band director eighth grade year, I think it was. So I had it for 5 years, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th. And the first thing I noticed about his playing was he sounded like a professional. We sounded like students. And that became my major, you know, major thing to overcome, the fact that I wanted to sound like him. And by the time I graduated from high school, I was sounding like him. And so you know, thinking back, this is the basic kind of concept, you know, was try to develop, you know, soul search yourself and try to develop what you think is inside you, and then, you know, and then go for it. That's what we did.
Captain, first introduce yourself, and I'm sure you have a question.
Hi, this is Captain Kirk speaking. Yes.
Yes, Mr. Maceo Barker.
Now,
hello.
Yes. Okay. Here's my question.
Okay.
I myself have been to Africa twice, and I thought it was very inspirational, you know, going to the motherland and feeling the vibe and spirit of the people. In the book, you had mentioned that you also yourself went to Africa. Could you just explain to the audience what you felt, your experience through that when you went to Africa, and the difference between Africa at the given time and what you felt in the United States?
Well, you know, you can't help but think once you're there, especially for the first time, you know, about the slavery trade stuff from long ago. And that's sort of like in the back of your mind. But then at the same time, you know, you're there, whatever the present time is, you know, you're trying to get, you know, make positive reasons why you are there. In fact, I was first went to Africa with James Brown, so I'm very excited anyway, because I'm working in James Brown's band, so I'm excited about that. But it's still Africa, like you said. I noticed that, you know, the music side of it, seemed like there were different rhythms that I hadn't heard before. And that kind of surprised me, like in a good way, because by this time now I think I've heard everything. You know, you can't kind of hook me up on a rhythm, not me. You know, I've been in the music all my life, but when I got there, man, I'm telling you, when I got there, there were like, I mean, stuff. Good Lord, this is different. I mean, it has a one, has a pulse, and all that, but it's different. And it was something that I really enjoyed and that embraced me, and had a profound thing about my being there and perhaps someday recording some stuff, you know, just going over and just doing some basic 100% African kind of a stuff. I never did, but that's what I was thinking about. And then, like I said, coupled in, you know, with that, and then in the back of your mind, hey, we went to a place called Gory Island, where back during the slave trade days, they would, you know, go out almost like the Roots thing, the Kuta Kente thing, all the exact same kind of deal, where it seemed like the slave guys, you know, have some kind of quota, maybe, you know, or we don't have enough yet. You know, and so got to be stored. You know, the slaves had to be stored in a warehouse kind of a thing, or a hole or whatever. And you know, say, okay, now we have enough, so we can go. And you know, I mean, it's emotions get you. You know, when you learn this stuff, and you can see firsthand, you know, about the shackles that were used, because all this stuff is artifact kind of, you know, and on display. And there's somebody, you know, walking around telling you what, you know, what went on and how, you know, it happened and all that. And somebody gets sick, you know, and you know, not a big deal. Oh, you're too sick to make the ship, fine, boom, throw overboard, you know, this kind of stuff. So it was like really mixed emotions. But then again, like, it's Africa, you know, the motherland and all that. So the emotions run from, like, A to Z, or they did for me anyway.
Okay. I want to mention something, ask you something about your go-to person musically. I will definitely confess my go-to person musically, along with you, of course, would be your colleague, Mr. Nelson. he's my go-to person. You're my go-to person. My father, who we affectionately call the tangential producer of the show, his go-to person is Wicked Pickett. Your go-to person is Ray Charles. Tell us a little bit about how Ray Charles really had an effect on you musically, how you really had a lot of respect for him musically, his talent.
Me and my brothers started listening to, you know, we wanted to hear everything that was recorded. And I do mean everything, all styles, all everything, country, western, you name it. And when we got to the point we started making money, you know, we could buy whatever we want to. So we wanted to buy everything, you know. And you know, my brother, hey, man, you got to listen to this. It may be a big band something or trio something or whatever. But anyway, it seems like once we got stacks and stacks and stacks of records, for me somehow, kind of like Ray Charles, like when I come from somewhere, come from school or whatever, and I say, you know, go, and then you know, your mind zip through everything and go to, you know what, I think I want to hear some Ray Charles. And I found myself, you know, kind of zooming in on Ray Charles a lot, to a point where, you know, I started asking myself, well, why is that? But then when I listened to Ray, it just seemed to me like whatever he's singing, he has experienced that already. So like, really, really authentic. Up and up, on in, out on the job. And I said, this guy. And then one time he even, you know, you sound like he was crying and all that. You know what I mean? Yeah, so I'm saying, Donnie, this guy, I mean, so what I did was, you know what, if I could play a ballad and have that kind of feeling that he has when he sings, then somebody got to like what I'm doing, you know. Then I was, as I got older, you know, at that time I didn't know, but as I got older, I got to a point where I could kind of imitate him a little bit. You know, sometimes you know how your voice is. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not. But sometimes I could, you know, kind of be close to it. So as I got older, you know, started having my own group, I started, you know, sort of incorporating that in my show, you know, some Ray Charles stuff. I do that now. But that's what he meant to me. Then to find out that he was blind, like, come on, man, this is my man. This is, you know. And let me tell you this story quickly. When I was a freshman in college, I had already seen Ray Charles maybe twice in my little local place where I was born, where I lived. But when I saw him in college and got a chance to go to see him on my own, at the end of the concert, I'm standing back in the back and I'm going, golly, wow, ooh, man, look at that Ray. There's the guys in the band. There's Hank Crawford and all that. You know, and then I just said, and I don't know why, I just said, you know what? One of these, and I pointed my finger and shook it. I said, one of these days, Mr. Ray Charles, one of these days, you're going to know me. You're going to know Maceo Parker. I didn't know what made me say it, and I verbally said it. I don't know what made me say that or feel it, but I did. And I actually said that. One of these days, you're going to know me. And that was 1961. In 2004 or 5, whatever, I opened for Ray Charles 3 weeks in Europe, and I have the banner now that says Maceo Parker and Ray Charles. And during one of those nights, he allowed me to come on stage with him to play some saxophone solo on one of his songs or something. But, you know, it's easy to reflect back on when one of these days, I don't know how I'm going to do it, one of these days, you're going to know me. You're going to know Maceo Parker. And somehow I made it happen.
Well, by that time, you were definitely a legend in your own right. So there must have been some kind of mutual admiration by that time.
Well, you know, thanks to James Brown, I always try to salute him as much as I possibly can. But thanks to him for sort of, you know, giving me that launch in my career, you know, especially when he started saying, you know, come on, Maceo, blow your horn, Maceo, Maceo, blow your horn, and blah, blah. I met a whole lot of people, man, in the business just because of that. And, it, you know, like, Maceo, you know, like imitating James Brown, like Eddie Murphy, for instance. You know, the first time I met him, he came to meet me. You know, from doing the James Brown, and, you know, you put your hand down by your belt and all that, and all the turn your feet,
right,
and all that. And then you do Maceo somewhere, And I met Michael Jackson the same way. I was working with Prince in Vegas, and everybody was saying, Michael's doing the All-Star basketball, NBA All-Star basketball thing was in Vegas once. And everybody was saying, Michael, we thought we were talking about Michael Jordan. But, you know, Michael is here, and turned out to be Michael Jackson. And next thing I know, he's walking up to me to meet me, you know, because, you know, he was a huge James Brown fan, you know. And I mean, you know, the list can go on and on and on, but those are two that just sort of stick out right now.
Let me not be remiss. Again, to our listening audience, we're speaking to Mr. Maceo Parker. He has a new book entitled 98% Funky Stuff, My Life in Music. Pick it up at Amazon. Definitely an excellent read. Could not get enough of it. 98% Funky Stuff, My Life in Music. When you mention Michael Jackson and you mention Prince, as I just said, one of my core artists, I have to ask you this question. How would you say he measures up with the Godfather in a sense? I mean, their styles are similar, but I mean, you have been able to work with the greatest artists. You know, people would kill to be in your position, obviously. So how do you work with the both?
I hear you. I really enjoy being, you know, who I am. And it's documented the way it all happened, you know, and that is, like I said, starting very really really young, searching yourself to figure out what it is you wanted to do, and how you wanted to play, you know, trying to come up with your own concept of, you know what, blah, saxophone number A does this way, number B does this way, number C does this way, maybe I won't do it exactly. But, you know, trying to have my own thing. Because one time I was thinking, since my name is Maceo Parker, I think Maceo Parker plays Charlie Parker. Yeah, that has a real nice sound. But then I said, no, that may not be a good idea. There may be some guy here named, you know, Joe Green or whatever, and, you know, who plays Charlie Parker. Anyway, what I'm getting to is, you know, I just tried to get my own concept and have my own thing. And I did. But that was kind of funky. And at the same time, I kind of felt like it would fit James Brown's, you know, style really, 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 really great. So when he heard me play, it was kind of like, whoa. You know, and he used to say, you know, like when I get tired or have to leave the stage to change clothes up, I just leave it out with Maceo. And Maceo is almost as if I'm still singing. He has that kind of a, you know, that kind of a thing. Right. Like that. Prince and James Brown, I call him geniuses, and that's just about all I can say about him. I love him. I love the fact that he, you know, appreciates what I do, what I have done, and all that. And I get a chance to work with him from time to time. But they're genius. I mean, they're genius, especially him. He does everything, you know, more than 100%. And that's really really genius, you know, for me. In my standards, I'll put it that way.
Captain, I know you have more questions. We don't want to take too much of Mr. Parker's time, but I know you have more questions. He knows where the bodies are buried, sir. He knows where the bodies are buried.
Let me interject something. I just thought of something else about Africa. This is kind of cool. Somehow, a lot of the hip cats over there thought Maceo was something that you say in greeting, like, what's happening? And the first time I went, okay, now the plane lands, and then, you know, Mr. Brown, you know, the people over there are waiting for him. Boom, he gets in his limousine and his entourage, and they flip off. But now the people are all on surrounding the airport, and they go, Maceo, Maceo, Maceo. Oh, what the world? What is this? And I come to find out that's what they all thought. They all thought, you know, it's something that you say in greeting. So, you know, before we got there and before they found out, they pass each other in greeting and go, Maceo. You know? And then when they found out, no, Maceo was one of the guys in the group, to a point where I couldn't even come out of the hotel, man. And people I was like the celebrity over there because they knew of Maceo, but they didn't know that Maceo was the person playing.
I bet James didn't like that.
Okay. Let me ask you this. How do you think your life would have been different if you would have been more seriously involved with the ladies in, let's say, your 16, 17, 18 year of age? What type, which way would your life have branched off to?
Let me really understand the question, because I heard you say 16, 17, 18, something that I didn't
Yes, okay. If you were more seriously involved with the ladies when you were a teenager, say 16, 17, 18, how do you think your life would have been different? Would it would have been the same? You know, just, you know,
well,
elaborate
with
that.
Yeah, if you mean like starting a family, you know, like getting really, really serious with someone and trying to start a family at that age, then I think I would have to, you know, to like try to, you know, support, be in a position where I support the family. So maybe I would probably have to take door number one rather than wait for door number two, door number three, if you can understand what I'm saying. I was in a position where I didn't have a lot of choices. I just had to take first thing where I could make whatever I could make just to support, you know, the family. There was, you know, I had a lot of girlfriends, but I didn't want to go to second base. I really didn't, because I didn't go to college, first of all, to find a wife. I didn't. I went to college at the time, I thought, you know, to get a degree and teach. But I got girlfriends. I had girlfriends, you know, back at home. So I don't, you know, it was fascinating, you know, to walk around with a cute little girl that, you know, from somewhere and all that. Somewhere different, you know, out of state and all that. It's kind of cute, but that's all I wanted. It turned out she kind of thought that maybe I was, you know, her junior, like somebody maybe younger than she or something, you know, because my intentions I didn't want my intention to go but so high, and so she decided, you know, well, you know, maybe I move on, but that's what I think. I don't think I would have been in the position where, you know, I could have picked and choose how I wanted to do my career, you know, if I'd have got really, really, really serious at a very, very early age. That's really what I think. Now, I think I could have played, you know, I'm still Maceo, and I still had the concept of playing the way I play, or the way I play, right? But I wouldn't have the luxury of waiting for concepts and you know, like the real deal to come along, like E. James Brown. I wouldn't just have to do, you know, like quickly go with whatever is there, whatever is available for me.
Okay.
How do you feel about the hip-hop community with their sampling of your sound, sampling of Mr. Brown's sound? I will say this much. I was very disappointed when Mr. Brown passed. I thought, as a knee-jerk reaction, I thought, well, the hip-hop community just has to come out and pay homage to Mr. Brown, because growing up on some of the hip-hop music, you could not have a hip-hop hit unless you sampled James Brown. No way.
Yeah.
No way. And I thought that it felt a little disappointing from my perspective. How could this be? You know, it was, especially from New York. Incidentally, I'm from St. Albans, and my parents and I used to actually ride our bikes by Mr. Brown's house when he lived in St. Albans.
Yeah.
But it just didn't make any sense to me. I mean, hip-hop would not exist if it were not for your work and Mr. Brown's work.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, you just can't, you know, focus on, you know, something that's not happening, something didn't happen, and, you know, negativities and all these kind of things. I mean, negative stuff and all that. But I hear you. I really do hear you. When it got to me that, you know, that I was being sampled a little bit, it was sort of like a twofold kind of a thing. First of all, you're kind of excited, kind of, you know, somebody kind of like your sound, where they feel like, man, this would be kind of nice in our tune and our records or our whatever, our recording. But then at the same time, you say, well, what right way or correct way to be, you know, get in touch with the guy, have him come in, you know, make some deal, have him come in and play. And then it's not sampling and it's not, you know, doing something that perhaps may have been illegal. I don't know. But we have been, we, I had a group called Mason and All the King's Men, and somebody from France, I think it was, years ago, sampled something, and we were handsomely rewarded for that. But, you know, so sometimes, you know, you get rewarded, sometimes you don't. But that was, you know, that's the nature of how things are.
Tell us about your work with George Clinton. It seems like you're dealing, because I love all your work and your colleagues, but to go from James Brown to George Clinton, it seems almost like it's like a different style, you know, as far as just Mr. Brown's known for being like almost a drill sergeant.
Yeah.
And then you have George Clinton, who's kind of, he's out there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's night and day. And I was excited like a little kid waking up for, you know, Christmas or my first days as a freshman in college. You know, I was just very, very excited. And then, you know, like you want to learn as much as you possibly can anyway about, you know, this new lifestyle. And that's the way it was with me with George Clinton. I couldn't believe it. I really couldn't believe it. No. You can't say that. No, you can't look that way. Come on, that guy doesn't have any shoes. No, come on, no. I mean, you know, coming from tuxedos, you know, dress decorum, you know, everything and blah, all this. I mean, straight up, you know, everything, shoes shine and all that. So a guy said, you know what, George, I'm into the Western genre, and would it be okay if I have like a lariat and some chaps and you know, the boots and this kind of thing and horse gear and all this and oh yeah that's fine that's okay. I'm going, what? And then another guy said, you know what, man, I'm into you know, the military. I like to wear our daughter. And so, yeah that's fine. George's whole concept was or is, first of all, he comes from outer space to teach the Earthling how to fuck. And it ain't nothing, life ain't nothing but a party. Life ain't nothing but a party. So you don't have to get all, excited about, you know, what the other guy is wearing next to you. You got to be uniformed. And, oh, come on. And then I used to question, you know, some of the lyrics. And I said, well, you know, this, you know, hey, Jay, you know, we're not in the locker room, man. You know, we're not in the football team locker room where you can say stuff. You know, you record it or say it, you know, on a live thing. You know, you may have some kids out there, and they kind of respect the females and stuff. And all. Hey, man, you know, you hear this stuff every day. They're going to hear it anyways. And they will hear it from me. So, okay.
Well, you've worked with so many people. I mean, you also had that issue in reading the book with Fishbone. Fishbone's another act I love. Fishbone,
yeah.
And you work with them also.
Not in a capacity where you know, I really really knew them, and I, you know, like we shared the same stage every now and then, but I didn't really really work with them to a point where, you know, I can call some of them names and, you know, help them groove on some grooves and stuff like that. No, didn't do that.
Right.
Not with them.
One last question, because I know your time is important. For our audience, we know about your longevity. You're still out there grooving, still funking. How did you stay away from the drugs and all that negativity? I mean, you know, music has been, you've been mentioned that in the book, that there were young ladies that when they heard you were in a band or trying for a band, that they looked down on that because at the time, they so much associated musicians with the drugs, and unfortunately some of the groups that you work with have been known, whether it was Mr. Clinton or later James Brown. How did
right.
you stay away from all that?
I started young, you know, with the same kind of way I was trying to, you know, build my own concept about how I wanted to play. When I heard, coming home from school, I think it must have been sixth grade, seventh grade, something like that. Hey, you going to that show we're going to have on the weekend? No, just two people talking to each other sitting on the porch. I'm just passing. No, because, you know, all those musicians, they only just get drunk and, you know, act silly and that kind of thing and you know, do drugs and all that. And I said, what? You know, it wasn't talking to me, but I heard it. And I said, you know what, maybe, just maybe, I can show people, you know, without really saying it, but I can show people that just because you're a musician, you do not necessarily have to do drugs and get drunk. And again, it's from that and the early upbringing, you know, with your family and stuff, instilling in us that you don't have to do that. You know, then I had uncles who did, sometimes my father did. And, you know, and you can see the difference in, you know, somebody who's intoxicated. You know, say, wait, whoa, what's going on here? Oh, okay, well, you know what? I got to stay away from that. That's what it is. It's kind of like it's an agreement that I made with Maceo. And when I look in the mirror in the morning doing my, you know, doing my teeth or doing my face, what, you know, I'm standing there one-on-one with myself. It's a disagreement that I did with me. I had to do a military thing, and everybody, okay, we're going to have, what is it, beer breaks and all that. Well, let me try this. I didn't even get half a beer down. You know, I just, you know, it's just not for everybody. And I'm just one of the people that just, you know, wasn't for.
You know, I'm sorry, one more thing. I mean, you really are a wealth of information. You live in history, so it's, you know, I have to speak to you on some of this stuff. Two quick things, actually.
Okay.
You played during the times of segregation, and when you read this, and when I speak to my father about this as well, it seems, you know, it's very hard for someone who's never dealt with that to put their minds as to how that works. I mean, in the book, you talk about having to get food in the back of the restaurants, and you know, sometimes you're getting threatened when it gets dark. You're playing at a house. A young man had said, "Let's, you know, I want you to come over and play for us." And then the cops are coming, and your group is African American. Just the way you navigate during the segregationist time, and how your brother actually, even he made history. Just by being a professor at Columbia, the law professor, but just what was it like to play during that period? I think people today, young musicians, need to really, really know what you dealt with and how their world is different because of what you were doing.
Well, first of all, I think you have to find out the rules. You know what the rules are. You know, like what's accepted and what's not. And then try to accept what is accepted, and slowly, and not too, you know, don't get too much in that. I want to change things now, because you have to keep in mind we were young. I mean, really, really young. We're still teenagers, you know, when all that happened, and there were older people, older musicians, you know, who we knew about. And we could kind of see and kind of learn how they did stuff, and or either we would either copy these older musicians or not. So we, you know, we are aware of situations, different situations. Then there were things that were passed down to us, like, hey man, did you hear about blah blah blah? Did da da da? And as a result of his doing da da da, he was da da da, which is not so good. So we stay away from that. There were times when we had to play. The only place we could play were like segregated white clubs or after school things. You know, we wanted to make the money. We did. And, you know, then there were, you know, sometimes little girls would come up and, you know, express, you know, a little interest and like, oh, I kind of like, you know, but we knew how far to go with that. Again, that was, you know, we're in Carolina now. You know, and that's the South, you know, but and at the same time, we knew, and the fact that when I say we, I'm still talking about me and my brothers, and so that, you know, we always could huddle up and figure out, hey man, no, okay, boom, boom, like, you know, like your football teams that huddle up and
right, make a decision, right.
Exactly, and so that was a luxury too, you know, to have, you know, the brothers there, cousins, whatever, all the time, and we just, no. Remember we said we're not going to do blood? Oh, yeah, right. Okay, boom, you know. But then next thing you know, there's another year's gone, and you get through it somehow, you know. And I was part of the sit-in stuff in Greensboro with Jesse Jackson and all those guys, Ezra Blair and all those guys doing that, you know. But I was lucky enough, like I said, to have a job, have a gig where I can keep a little money in my pocket and at the same time send money home to mom. You know, that became, you know, kind of important to me. So staying out of jail was very important for me. You know, so I'll march and, you know, carry the sign and sing and all that, but I got a gig on the weekend I gotta make it. I let them understand
right. That.
They had to understand that. So you guys got to understand that. Now, you know, I'll do everything except I can't miss my gig because, you know, that's really important for me, you know, for, you know, to send money home and all that. And so that's what I did. And they understood it.
Wow. Do you have any websites or anything that where your fans can reach you?
It's not really me. I delegate that work for somebody else, but it's kind of sounding like it's me, which is okay. But sometimes they come to me and say, you know, my managers and people come to me and say, oh yeah, what do you think about that? I'll say, just say blah 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 blah, like that.
So
but it's Maceo@Maceo.com, where people can find out, you know, where I'm going, what I've been doing, stuff like that.
Your schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Parker, it's been an absolute pleasure. I appreciate you coming through. Definitely one of my highlights. We will continue to support your music, and we'd like to have you back if you have any other projects, if you have another album another book. I think you have another book in you, actually. So believe it or not, I think there's still more you haven't told.
But this is sort of important, too. I still do it, man. And I started doing it from day one out of love. A great big old boldface, LOVE. And I love people. I love playing. I love performing. I love music. And if you come to one of my concerts, you'll hear me say more than once, on behalf of all of us, we love you.
All right.
Sir, it's been an absolute pleasure. And I will be at one of your concerts. Trust me. I will.
Okay, partner.
Next time you come to New York. Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Parker. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank
bye
you.
Now.
Right. Folks, that
Yo.
Was legendary. Legendary.
Thank you.
That
right
was
now.
The legendary. But that was the legendary Maceo Parker, folks. It doesn't get any better than that. And as I promised, we're always going to have stellar guests like that. I mean, a wealth of history. What did you think, Captain? I mean, there's a lot I didn't ask him because I didn't want to, really just.
Yeah, well, due to time constraints, there's a lot. We actually could have went on to about 12 o'clock, to tell you the truth.
He wasn't going over that.
Yeah,
but
you know, just saying, you know, but you know, there's a lot to ask him. You know, there's a long history.
Captain, we got to go to another segment. But I want to play, I didn't really want to get into any real music playing, because I really wanted to pick his brain and really get into what he accomplished. I mean, you know, again, walking history. So let's go to one of Maceo Parker's grooves. When we get back, we're going to talk about actually what happened with this young man in Georgia, this infant that was killed. We have to talk about that. Folks, of course, we have a double show coming up this Sunday. Do you think Sunday or Saturday? We'll talk about that later, Captain. We may have to change up on that. But let's go to one of the infamous grooves, and we'll be back with more discussion. This is Past the Peas, but you knew that. More funk. We'll be right back. Thank you. we're back. We're back. Again, this is Afternoon Radio, the Midweek and Review Edition. The call-in number is 646-915-9628. Again, 646-915-9620. Captain, you know, behind the scenes, we were talking about this case in Georgia that is completely horrific. I mean, it's something that I can barely talk about, to be honest with you, because I just when you think you've heard it all, just when you think you've heard it all, it could never get any worse. It gets worse. It gets worse. So, from my understanding, we have a 13-month-year-old child who was killed point-blank range by some thugs. With the mother there, they were asking for money. She didn't have any money. And they threatened the child, and they owned up to their threats. I mean, you know, and I mean, Captain, it just, you know, when we talk about this stuff, what are your thoughts?
Well, that's just a feral beast at that given point, at that standpoint. You know, the kids are running around just in a feral mindset. And this might as well be a bunch of werewolves. You know, that's the behavior of a werewolf. Mythological creature, by the way. But that's just the behavior of a werewolf. Human beings do not behave in that manner. Not at all. You know, it's totally disgusting at this given point. That is disgusting. Was it really worth it? It's never really worth it. Rhetorical question, you know? That's all I can really say about it. That's all I can really say. Totally appalling. Totally appalling. Back over to you, Sir Affleck.
Yeah, just to give further clarification as far as to what happened, this again happened in Brunswick, Georgia. And pretty simple, the mother, Sherry West, was going out just taking a stroll with her child when she was accosted by these juveniles. The main culprit, allegedly, 17-year-old DeMarcus Elkins, again, DeMarcus Elkins, the 14-year-old that he accompanied him, because of his age, has been not identified. You know, they had not released his name. But to think that this could happen to this degree. Now, listen, we heard about another child that was killed in a gang accident. I mean, a gang incident in Chicago a few weeks ago. And that is horrific. I think that child was only 6 months old, right? That was even younger than the 13-month-year-old. I mean, that was horrific, and it cannot be excused, but it's still as heinous as that was. I thought that was about as worse as it could get, as bad as it could get. But then this is intentional. Well, then you think about Adam Lanza, who took out 20 children, but right between the eyes with this infant. And now we're talking about, now it's getting into a racial thing now, because the infant was white, the mother was white, and the perps are of African-American descent. And now there's another story that's attached to this, Captain, that's actually tangentially, we always use that word, that is tangentially attached to that story, Robert Zimmerman. Now, for those who are in the know, Robert Zimmerman is the brother of George Zimmerman, who is currently, I guess, about to go to trial at some point for the Trayvon Martin killing. He tweets out, after this incident with the 13-month-year-old being killed tragically, he tweets out that, hey, in essence, I'm paraphrasing, you have to watch out for these young black, these teens. These black teens, I think he said, are shaky. Something to that effect, that trusting black teens is a shaky proposition. Because he's connecting the Trayvon Martin incident
with the incident with this child. Your thoughts, sir?
Well,
can he do that? Can he do that?
Well, somebody such as himself seems like at this given time he has diarrhea of the mouth. He needs just to be quiet at this given time because he doesn't want too much more light put on his brother. So he just needs to just shut his mouth, shut his trap. Even though they might be based on the latest actions that we've seen in the media, there might be some credence to what he's saying. They might be, I'm saying. I'm not saying it's definitely, I'm not saying it's a scientifically proven fact or anything like that. But he's not in the position, given his brother's position, at this given time to really say anything, because the light will reflect on his brother's situation in a negative, in a more negative manner. So he just needs to shut his trap. Back over to you, Sir Afflinger.
Yeah, you know, I got into trouble with Robert Redding. he actually gave me the whip. I don't have the sound clip. I'll have the sound clip ready by the next show. But it's rather comical. I suspect he wanted to give me the whip from last week when I talked about the need to militarize some of these black communities, the need to have listen, for some folks, you know how this works, Captain. I've mentioned this before, and it somehow is shocking to some folks. But then when you start to hear these stories and you start to lay it out, all of a sudden people are starting to say, hey, maybe we might have to look at martial law a little bit more closely. Drones, we do have drones in this country. The police are a paramilitary force. They have drones. Certain people of means, private citizens, have drones. So when I mentioned that, you know, some of this violence is so over the top in our communities, and let's face it, the men, we fantasize, Captain, we fantasize that the men are going to return to prominence and come in as father figures to straighten out some of these ne'er-do-wells. We fantasize about that, but it doesn't seem to be happening. So if it's not going to happen, you might have to have government intervention. So when I went in that direction, he didn't crack the whip, but he wanted to. So when I called up about Robert Zimmerman and said that basically what you said, he's out of pocket, tribalism, one black teen translates to millions of black teens, which you just cannot do. You just can't do that. But I did say, Captain, that black folks and white folks have to do the due diligence in discernment, making distinctions. If Zimmerman had worded that a little differently, it might not have gone off that well, but at least it might have been understood. He didn't use discernment. He's not sophisticated. That's the problem. Now, the reality is we do have to look at some of our black teens. We do. There is a problem. But what happened to Trayvon, as much as I have issues with how that case went down, the reality is Trayvon had the right to be there. He was unarmed. And if George Zimmerman had conducted himself a certain way, and if Trayvon had conducted himself a certain way, they would have been two ships passing in the night, Captain.
Absolutely.
Would have been a non-traversy. If at least one person in between these two had enough cognition to move a piece of lint, if one of the two for two would have been 100%. But if one of the two had enough brain power to move a piece of lint, then both of these individuals would have come out unscathed. I said this early on. No one wants to talk about what really happened. They're interjecting race when this is brown versus black, although some folks want it to be white versus black, but it really is brown versus black, and that within itself causes a diminution. diminution. And that's what it really boils down to. When it's brown versus black, people go, eh, doesn't mean that much in the scheme of things. If George Zimmerman had identified himself, asked a simple question, remained put, followed directions, this would have been another day. If Trayvon was a different kind of youth and just said, hey, my father lives up the block, that would have been the end of it. Somehow, that didn't happen. But Robert Zimmerman is not doing his brother he's doing his brother a disservice by talking. He's talking and give you more insight as to how this family thinks. And that's what's problematic. But I do want more people, you know, more urban radio. For some reason, Captain, I want you to talk about this also. We got about 2 minutes, though. Urban radio is not talking about this child that was killed in Georgia. They're staying away from it. I think we were so shameful of this that we don't want to talk about it. But this has to be, if this is true, and you have kids shooting babies, shooting infants, we have a problem. How come urban radio isn't talking about this?
Well, that's the daft mindset of urban radio. It's not there to spit rhetoric of truth. It's just there to try to make you feel good. That's the reality of it. So they don't really want to venture into that zone, because the truth, a lot of times you have to look in the mirror and it's not going to feel good. And then when you deal with truth, you have to be responsible. And we know in the black community, you don't want to be responsible for anything, even if you are. So that's the last thing that they will do. Back over to you, Seraph. Time is limited. What are we going to do, Saturday or Sunday?
I think it's going to be Saturday, actually.
All right, let's go. So everybody,
okay.
Saturday, we'll do this at 6
Saturday.
P.m., the comic shop, and then 7, the Afro Nerd featuring Captain Kirk segment.
Sounds good. It's been real. And going out with more, Maceo Parker. This is Uptown Up. Uptown Up. It's been a pleasure, folks. See you on Saturday.
one order to wait, just in case. So fax me, fax me, $100 bill. It takes skills for getting your money straight and will. Self-pressure, the need to succeed till you really come to struggle to get more than you need. My feet is Mach 1, like Top Gun, as I cruise the ferry with no ordinary Tom, Dick, or Don. Drunk tight to late at night, from party hopping and Gotham Greek Showtime and clubs are cock. So take a flight on the wild side, but keep it a stride. Get so city so much you can call it Jekyll and Hyde. Divided by the green, I mean, more box tops and scrapers in town. So put a green on down, uptown.